Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 67 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or you can follow the discussion there. Or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Remington Lee-Nevin about the malaria drug mefloquine, also known as Lariam, and especially its neurotoxic side effects. Dr. Nevin is a consulting physician epidemiologist, board certified in public health and general preventive medicine by the American Board of Preventive Medicine. He specializes in the evaluation of adverse reactions to drugs like mefloquine. He was the first to publish clinical descriptions of the lasting toxic syndromes of brain and brainstem injury caused by the use of this drug, and collaborated on the first review of the drug's effects published in the forensic psychiatry literature. He testified before the U.S. Senate on the drug's strong ties to suicide and violence, and lasting neurological and psychiatric effects which confound the diagnosis and management of PTSD and traumatic brain injury. He's currently doing research in the Department of Mental Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he's a Doctor of Public Health candidate. He's trying to understand the mechanisms and clinical effects of antimalarial drug toxicity, which he hopes will better inform the rational use of these drugs. And his research has, in fact, influenced the recent FDA black box warning for mefloquine and the U.S. Army Special Forces ban on its use. He was himself in the U.S. military as a preventive medicine officer between 2005 and 2012, including a 2007 stint at Bagram Airfield, Afghanistan. Before I get to Dr. Nevin, a little bit of feedback. Alice Drager, who was the guest on episode 66, wrote to her publisher, "Great interview just now with David Crowe of Infectious Myth. It will air on Progressive Radio Network next Tuesday. He's copied here. I highly recommend him." Antanas, via email, wrote, "Hello there. I'm really enjoying your podcasts." Annette, also via email, wrote, "Thanks so much for your show, David. I particularly enjoyed the polio trial program where you interviewed yourself. Very inventive. I listen every week on PRN.FM, mostly via the archives. Yours is among my top 10 weekly listens. I'm meeting with my Washington State representative on Wednesday to discuss his co-sponsorship this past spring of a bill to eliminate the philosophical exemption to vaccines. Rumor has it that he'll do it again in the fall. I wonder if you had 10 minutes of your state rep's time, what strategy would you use?" I wrote back that my opinion, and it's only that, is that it's important to come up with a simple, strong, and non-emotional message that focuses on simple and relatively objective facts. One of the most powerful is to focus on adverse events. I'll send you a letter that I wrote to a politician in Canada that summarizes my position in reference to mandatory vaccination, and you're welcome to take anything from it that will help. I would suggest that you come up with a one-page or two-page document, including references. Politicians are too busy and generally not scientifically trained to absorb more. And now I'd like to go to our guest, Dr. Nevin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, David. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk today about a pretty important issue, which is the issue of the drug mefloquine, which is used to prevent malaria, especially in soldiers. So can you describe how it's being used, say, by the U.S. military? I know it's being used elsewhere around the world as well.
Sure, David. And there is the question of pronunciation. Some people say mefloquine. Here in the U.S., commonly pronounced mefloquine. Both pronunciations are correct, but I might move between each pronunciation.
Okay. That's okay. They're close enough.
Yeah. Mefloquine or mefloquine was actually developed by the U.S. Military some decades ago. During the Vietnam War, there was rising concern that resistance to the then leading drug, chloroquine, was becoming excessive and threatening lives. And so the military invested, I believe, hundreds of millions of dollars in a multi-decade drug development program. And the drug that would later become known as mefloquine was first reportedly synthesized in 1969, and it was a quickly singled out for further large-scale development, and it underwent early phase clinical testing in the 70s and 80s and was ultimately licensed here in the United States in 1989. And it was licensed both for treatment of malaria infection when a person's showing symptoms from disease and needs to be treated, but it was also licensed for prevention, and the difference is simply in the dosage. So the same drug is used to prevent illness and to treat the illness if it gets out of hand. And because of the chemical properties of mefloquine, lipid-soluble, it tends to have a long serum half-life. It was thought ideal for the purposes of prevention in military settings because you could take it once a week.
Right.
And that was conceived of as very convenient. Soldiers who are busy fighting a war, they may not remember to take a pill every day. And with mefloquine, you could have a formation or you could line up the soldiers once a week and administer the pill to each and theoretically protect them all from malaria. So it was very popular. It became the military's drug of choice. And it was only some years later when rising concerns first expressed in the media and then echoed in a number of scientific publications that the drug was inherently dangerous and extremely poorly tolerated, did the military even consider moving away from mefloquine.
Can I just ask first, how did they determine that mefloquine was effective at preventing or treating malaria?
Yeah, that's a very good question, David. So if you ask a drug regulator today what is the standard for proving efficacy, they would generally want to see the results of the double-blinded placebo-controlled trial of some kind that
right.
would be used during phase three submissions prior to licensing. Now, there are some technical problems with that, some ethical problems with that. When you're testing drugs against potentially lethal diseases, a placebo comparator may not be appropriate. And so the early studies done with mefloquine lacking an ideal comparator made use of study designs that by today's standards I think we would consider suboptimal.
Right.
Now, there's no doubt that mefloquine has efficacy. The drug is a schizonticidal agent. It does kill the malaria parasites. But there's a big difference between efficacy and real-world effectiveness. And
right.
The problem with mefloquine is we now realize it can take many, many weeks of weekly dosing for the drug to build up in the red blood cells where they act as an anti-malarial agent. And during
right.
this time, the drug is accumulating in lots of other organs, including brain. And often what happens is the drug begins to exert adverse effects in brain even before it's built to effective levels in the blood. And so the user is forced to discontinue the drug. During that time, they've taken on the risk of
right.
potentially permanent psychiatric and neurological effects from the drug's CNS effects while deriving no anti-malarial benefit. So I think a sober look at the drug in retrospect might suggest to us it should have never been licensed. But unfortunately, at the time that it was undergoing regulatory review by FDA and others, the regulators didn't have all of the information
right.
available to them that they should have had about these concerns.
Yeah. Okay. And is the fact that it's absorbed into the, it's lipid-soluble, does that... You said that means that it stays in the body longer, and presumably that means that if you have side effects, that they would therefore take longer to dissipate because it is absorbed in the fatty tissues.
Yeah, and that is an important characteristic, but we should emphasize that it's quite naive to think that the drug's effects are limited to its continued presence in the body. And for many decades, the thinking was that the long duration of adverse effects that had been noted were linked to this long serum half-life. And that would make sense if the drug was not a neurotoxicant, if the drug was merely exerting transient pharmacological effects on brain tissue as it was slowly effluxed from the body or metabolized, these effects would go away. But we now understand, and we should have really known at the time of the drug's development, that the drug is a neurotoxicant. And so at a certain threshold concentrations, the drug actually causes permanent, irreversible injury to the central nervous system. You can think of it somewhat like lead and mercury, not quite the same. But lead and mercury are CNS neurotoxicants. Even after you excrete the lead or mercury, the damage remains.
Right.
And that's no different than with this class of drugs, the quinolines, that include mefloquine. They're all inherent neurotoxicants.
Okay. And does that go for the predecessor, like chloroquine, that had similar side effects? Or?
Yeah, absolutely, David. And this is what I think has escaped notice until recently. The mefloquine is just the latest in a long series of synthetic quinoline or quinoline drugs that date to the their original development by the Germans in the 1920s. Prior to that, the quinoline drug that was commonly used was the naturally occurring extract of the cinchona plant, quinine or quinidine, which is a stereoisomer. So these drugs were commonly used as antimalarials, but after the turn of the century, after concerns that the supply of these drugs might be limited, as they indeed were in World War II by the Axis powers, there was greater attention paid to synthesizing synthetic alternatives. And the Germans had done some early work in the 20s synthesizing a drug called quinacrin, which you can think of as a substituted quinoline. And then the Germans invented a drug called pamiquin, or plasmachin, and plasmacid. Those are eight amino quinolines. And then during the World War II drug development effort that the U.S. military sponsored, we developed an extraordinary number of synthetic compounds to include what would become chloroquine and a drug we still use today called primaquine. But these drugs are all quinolines or quinolines in that they share the quinoline structural core.
Right. Okay, so that's kind of the history. Now, what were the first side effects that the military saw that made them stop dosing some soldiers with this, or did they just continue, being the military, just continue to give the drugs regardless?
Well, the history of why the U.S. military shifted its position on the mefloquine isn't certain. Unlike most travel medicine authorities, unlike most private clinicians who have over the years developed experience primarily with the side effects of mefloquine and deemed the risk-benefit simply too great owing to these side effects, the military, in contrast, seems to have adopted a different logic for why it stopped using the drug. The military has been very reluctant to acknowledge side effects from the drug and to acknowledge the possibility that these side effects may have complicated the diagnosis and management of other neuropsychiatric conditions related to deployment and combat, such as PTSD or TBI.
Right.
They've been very reluctant to open that can of worms. But the military had other good reasons to move away from mefloquine, and I think the reason it's tended to focus on has been the fact that the product label for mefloquine in the United States and in a number of other jurisdictions, it warns that you should not use the drug in those with a history of certain psychiatric or neurological problems. And the reason for this isn't spelled out carefully in the product insert. It's been often erroneously believed that only if you have a history of depression or only if you have a history of anxiety do these side effects develop in you if you take the drug. But that's actually not true. The drug causes symptoms of depression and anxiety in between 1 to 10% of users of the drug. And symptoms such as abnormal dreaming or sleep disturbance occur in upwards of 10% of users of the drug taking one tablet a week. What happens, I think, and I think this is the reason for the contraindication, is that let's suppose you have a history of mild depression or mild anxiety, and so you're used to those symptoms. They're familiar to you, and you begin to take mefloquine, and owing only to the effect of the drug on your CNS, you begin to experience new symptoms of anxiety. Well, you may, if you have a history of anxiety, you may attribute those symptoms not to the drug, but to your pre-existing condition. You may think, oh, my anxiety is coming back. I will take my Paxil, or I'll take my Xanax,
right.
Or I'll do whatever I used to do to control my anxiety. And you'll miss the fact that that symptom is actually an early warning sign of drug toxicity. So you may continue to take the drug.
Right.
And that's very risky, because these early symptoms are an indication that you are susceptible to the drug CNS toxicity. And so with repeated dosing over time, the drug may build up in your brain to toxic levels that could cause irreversible injury. So I think the fact that individuals with pre-existing conditions, their recognition of drug toxicity is confounded. And
right.
So they may not discontinue the drug as quickly as they should. I think that's the reason for the contraindications. But what's really tragic is that these contraindications listed on the label have led many people to assume that only those with a history of a psychiatric illness are susceptible to the drug's toxicity. And that's completely wrong. That's equivalent to saying that only people with a history of autism or mild mental disorders are susceptible to lead toxicity,
right.
which is obviously ridiculous.
And would you get into the military if you had symptoms of depression or anxiety or a psychiatric condition like that ahead of time?
Well, so ideally the military would not recruit or assess individuals with anything but a perfect medical history.
Right.
But beggars can't be choosers, as
right.
the saying goes. And in recent years in particular, the military has had to relax its accession standards, its recruiting standards, and in some cases even really just turn a blind eye to the rules. And so it's recruited many people with pre-existing mental disorders. A number of studies out of the Army in recent years have shown really what can be described only as an epidemic of pre-existing, very severe mental disorders among new recruits. And I think this reflects the fact, some people would say, for example, that you have to be a little crazy to join the military at a time of war when you know you're going to be going overseas. Who in their right mind would join the military
knowing
they would be deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan?
Right.
And to extent that's true, what we see is that with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, obviously always we've had a large number of very patriotic, highly qualified volunteers, but they don't exist in numbers large enough to meet recruiting goals. And so
right.
what the military's done is it's accepted a large number of people that really don't have many other places to go. Individuals with criminal backgrounds, with low educational attainment, people who've struggled with drug and alcohol abuse,
right.
and in some cases who've struggled with very severe mental disorders, who can't keep a job elsewhere, they for a number of years found a very welcoming home in the military. And so it's not unreasonable to say two-digit percentages of some cohorts of new recruits had very serious problems that
right.
clearly would be a contraindication to use of this drug, but also have other significant implications for the health of the force.
Is it also possible that the side effects of the drugs could be misinterpreted as the onset of some of these psychiatric disorders like depression that have kind of vague diagnoses anyway, like a wide spectrum?
Yeah,
effect?
Okay, so it's a valid point. So the product insert clearly says that the drug causes symptoms of anxiety and depression in between 1 to 10% of people. And we know that, especially with a recent study out of Denmark, that many of these symptoms can last for years. And so we can conclude from this that the drug is inducing or causing new episodes of mental illness in some percentage of the individuals that used it. Now, it becomes somewhat of a semantic question. Does the individual have a new onset depression or a new onset anxiety disorder, or do they have a new onset mefloquine toxicity disorder that manifests in these other ways? There is no diagnosis yet of mefloquine toxicity syndrome. We don't have a name for the chronic sequelae caused by this drug. Perhaps one day we will. But in the absence of recognition of this syndrome, and in absence of the widespread recognition that the drug can have these effects, undoubtedly many hundreds, if not thousands, of veterans who've taken this drug and who've reported very severe symptoms from it have come home and have been diagnosed with any number of conditions. And in my experience dealing with the patients and reviewing charts, these have included diagnoses such as bipolar disorder, mania, major depression, brief psychotic disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and in some cases, due to the ubiquitousness of the head injury, many of the disorders have been attributed to things like traumatic brain injury.
Right, and that would, to a doctor, maybe make sense because it might have been some time since the soldier had taken the mefloquine, and the doctor back home might not even be aware that the drug was given. So they're just seeing symptoms. It wouldn't necessarily connect it to the use of the drug months before.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I think two things in the military environment serve to really confound proper attribution. The first is that many of the symptoms of the mefloquine toxicity resemble those of traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, the lasting nightmares, lasting cognitive problems, lasting heightened anxiety or intermittent panic states.
Right.
And then on the TBI side, problems with memory, temporospatial disorientation, irritability, aggression, various cognitive disorders. And so in military settings, exposure to traumatic stress is ubiquitous. In some surveys, majority of individuals report experiencing one of the conditions that used to be a criteria A in the diagnosis of PTSD, witnessing,
right,
observing an event that's very traumatic, and so on. And so the specificity of that diagnosis is far less in military settings owing to the ubiquitousness of the traumatic exposures. And similarly,
right,
it's very easy to attribute lasting cognitive problems to an assumed concussion that a soldier may not remember. So if you were in the military for many years, likely that you were involved in some sort of IED blast, it's very easy to say, well, you were probably concussed and you don't remember it.
Right.
That's probably what's going on with you. You probably had a concussion. So from the perspective of caring for the patient, making sure they get the disability benefits they need, if symptoms caused by mefloquine are being misattributed to PTSD or TBI and the soldier is getting medical care and benefits, then you could argue, well, maybe it's okay. Maybe they're not falling through the cracks. But I would argue that if a sizable percentage of this problem is due not to PTSD and TBI, but due to mefloquine, then not only is clinical care being adversely impacted, treatments for PTSD are not going to necessarily work for mefloquine, and treatments for TBI are not necessarily going to work for mefloquine, but also the absolute burden, the magnitude of this epidemic is being missed.
Right, and the use of the drug is just going to go on because the damage that it's caused is being overlooked.
Yeah, or misattributed. Right.
Right.
In some cases, it's difficult to overlook these problems, but in military settings, it's very easy to misattribute,
right,
PTSD.
And are there treatments for mefloquine toxicity? I mean, you say it makes permanent brain changes. Are there any ways to mitigate the problems that it has caused?
Yeah, very good question, and I wish I could answer that for you. So in order to answer the question, is there a treatment that works for a given condition, what you really have to do is you have to assemble a group of people with the condition and give some a treatment and then give some a placebo,
mm-hmm,
and then see over time if folks with treatment do better on some standardized measure. And we're so early in our understanding of this disorder that we haven't even really defined formally the disorder. It's difficult for someone not involved in research in this area to define what a case of mefloquine toxicity is. So we're many years from knowing for sure. But there's reason to be both optimistic and somewhat skeptical. So reasons for optimism are that in some ways the damage caused by this drug, it does have this recognizable pattern. A lot of people who suffer mefloquine toxicity suffer chronic symptoms of dizziness, disequilibrium, vertigo, visual sensitivity. It's often mistaken for agoraphobia or fear of open places, but
right,
what it really is vestibular dysfunction, or a dysfunction of the brainstem's ability to integrate all of the various signals that control balance.
Right.
And what we found, anecdotally, is that many of these patients benefit from simple rehabilitation. So they go to a vestibular specialist or a physical or occupational therapist, and sometimes an intervention as simple as giving them a cane to help them walk with, or giving them a pair of sunglasses to cut down on some of the glare and brightness can help significantly if you reduce dizziness and stimuli that provoke vestibular decompensation. You can reduce anxiety and help improve concentration to a great degree. So to that extent, there might be some simple therapies that can help. But now the bad news is that the underlying injury is probably irreversible. And so the same way that a concussion or traumatic brain injury results in permanent changes, it can't really be fixed. They can be somewhat mitigated, but they can't be fixed. So too, I think, with mefloquine toxicity, the damage done to the brain is irreversible.
And does it, like you've mentioned before, hallucinations, bad dreams, do those tend to taper off at all, or if people had them when they started the drug, do they pretty much continue at the same level?
Yeah, so great question. It appears that the full range of symptoms that you experience during acute drug toxicity or acute drug intoxication, which can be as bad as psychosis with hallucinations, delusions, paranoid delusions particularly, and memory loss, it appears that even that is possible many years after the fact. But I think the good news is that those most severe of symptoms, the amnesia, the profound amnesia, and the profound delusional or confusional or manic psychosis that can occur, that is relatively infrequent long term. But the symptoms that do tend to stick around for many people are sort of a mild change in personality, mild change in mood and mood regulation. Sleep problems are particularly notable, and nightmares that persist are quite common. And again, this is different than post-traumatic stress disorder, because these occur in individuals who've taken the drug and who've never deployed.
Taking
the drug, a couple tablets later, they're suffering very severe symptoms. They don't have any other confounding condition, and yet years later they report these debilitating nightmares.
I was going to ask you about that, because you know, many people might say, "Well, you were at war, you saw horrible things, and that's why." But if this has occurred in people who took the drug without having experienced the trauma of war, then that's much clearer evidence for the toxicity.
And you know, David, as I've studied this issue more and more, I've become more and more suspicious, actually, of the construct that we refer to as post-traumatic stress disorder. I have no doubt there is a genuine disorder called post-traumatic stress disorder that results in many of the symptoms currently described in the DSM that result from exposure to trauma. But we have to keep in mind that what we call post-traumatic stress disorder was only first developed as a diagnosis in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. It first became an official diagnosis in the DSM in 1980, in the DSM-3.
Right.
And prior to that, we were aware of a number of different disorders that were unique to military settings, dating back to World War I, World War II, gross stress reaction, and so on. And then it was really the advocacy of Vietnam War veterans who said, look, we are suffering from something that no one understands, that is unique to our condition, and you need to give a name to it. And out of that advocacy came post-traumatic stress disorder. Many people will say, well, you know, military folks get PTSD. What you're describing with this drug is no different than PTSD. But I would remind them that we've used these drugs many decades prior to the onset of the disorder called PTSD. And is it possible that what we call PTSD might have actually, in many cases, represented the chronic sequelae of drugs of this class, dating all the way back to World War I, when we used quinine or quinine very commonly, dating back to World War II when we used Adabrin very commonly. And Adabrin was known to induce a terrible manic, confusional, paranoid psychosis in troops in the South Pacific and elsewhere in World War II. Could many of the soldiers that have come back from those theaters where Adabrin was used with long-term problems with cognition and terrible nightmare disorder, could they have been suffering long-term effects from Adabrin? Similarly, in Vietnam, where we use chloroquine and primaquine together that have the exact same effects as mefloquine, could they have been suffering the long-term effects of that drug combination?
So are there a major group of soldiers who have not taken these drugs, who have not been deployed to places where malaria is believed to be prevalent?
It's a fascinating question, because these drugs have been used ubiquitously in combat settings. They're very relatively few combat deployments where these drugs have not been widely used. And so it's an extraordinary confounder. It's a ubiquitous exposure. I would think relatively rare to find soldiers in wars of prior decades, including our most recent wars, where there was not some potential co-exposure to mefloquine or some other quinoline drug with the combat. From the perspective of epidemiology, it's going to prove very difficult to tease out these effects.
And another thing, one might think that in a case of true PTSD, that something was induced solely by the effects of battle, that things like talk therapy might be effective over time, that the symptoms could reduce with some kind of talk therapy, but that might not be the case with mefloquine.
Yeah, possibly. I'm not an expert in the treatment of a pure PTSD, but yeah. I will say that there might be some ability to disentangle the two things. And assuming that the service member didn't have a concussion, which is a big assumption, you know, many of my patients have not only psychiatric symptoms, but they're struggling with neurological problems. And many of them have been diagnosed with PTSD. And I remind them that PTSD does not cause vertigo.
Right.
It does not cause dizziness.
Mm-hmm.
And so if soldiers return from a war and they have chronic problems with mood or syndrome that resembles PTSD, but they're also dizzy, they're sensitive to light, they have vertigo, and they don't have a plausible concussion history, which is difficult in some cases, then a purely psychiatric diagnosis may not be appropriate. And if they did have a history of use of this drug, and they reported symptoms during use of the drug, then the possible diagnoses expand considerably from that.
Right. I saw that you wrote a review of a book about a man, David Stewart McLean, who believed that he got severe amnesia following mefloquine. And you've talked about memory loss, but can you briefly describe his experiences? And did you believe that this was an authentic story?
Yeah, what a fascinating case. So I point out the irony and seeming contradiction of his book, which is a memoir of amnesia. Right? He describes his recollections of his case of amnesia, but from his perspective, he can do this. So his recollection is that he basically awoke as if from a dream, standing on a train platform in India.
Right.
And he had no recollection of who he was or where he had come from or what he was doing there. And it was only through the assistance of a very kindly tourist police officer that happened to be there on the platform that he gradually regained his identity. He found out who he was, and his memories gradually came back to him. But he was left with this lacunar period of complete amnesia spanning a day or so. That seems to have corresponded to a period of intoxication from the drug he was taking, Larium or mefloquine, that he was taking to prevent malaria on his trip. And looking back, he can recollect experiencing early symptoms of the drug's toxicity. His personality was a little off. He was a little agitated or paranoid.
Right.
And in the aftermath of his awakening, he did suffer through intermittent psychosis for some time. So perfectly consistent with mefloquine symptoms. I wouldn't imagine he would fake this.
No.
His story is perfectly plausible. And in fact, you know, there are elements to the syndrome that require that are consistent with some fairly complex neurobiology. And his recollection, for example, of emotional memories and of the ability to sort of by rote remember how to type a password without really knowing what he was doing, that reflects our understanding of the different kinds of memories. We can lose autobiographical memory, and we can lose memory of specific recent events, and yet still know that when we type our password on a keyboard, for example, we type a certain way, and we don't know even what we're typing, but we remember. And we can remember, when suffering from an amnesia of this type, we can remember emotions and faces and the sort of emotional valence of our friends and family, even though we might not be able to remember who they are and what we did with them. And he experienced all of these things. So he felt comfortable around his family without really knowing who they were. He remembered his internet password without knowing what it was. And this is all perfectly consistent with a certain type of memory loss that we would expect from Mefloquin, seemingly unbelievable, but perfectly consistent.
He was not a soldier. He was a tourist taking this as a malaria preventive.
Yeah, that's right. And it's quite frightening to think of the consequences of episodes like this occurring in soldiers. How many soldiers have experienced a similar episode of memory loss, amnesia, brief confusion, and yet retaining their ability to participate in rote tasks.
Right. I mean, that could be incredibly dangerous to a group of soldiers who are on patrol or something when one of their fellow soldiers basically blanks out.
Yeah. And, you know, David Stewart McLean, he remembered how to eat. It's not as though he forgot how to use his knife and fork and eat dinner. And I imagine that a soldier suffering from Mefloquin amnesia would remember how to load his gun and fire his gun. And if everyone else was shooting at the bad guys, he would probably do the same thing.
Right.
So it's quite frightening to think of the effects of Mefloquin amnesia and Mefloquin psychosis in soldiers. And, of course, we've had a number of episodes in recent decades where we've suspected that Mefloquin could be implicated. And, of course, that most recently, that suspicion was entertained in the case of Robert Bales.
Right. I was going to ask you about that case. He went out and killed, I think, 16 Afghanis, just left the base and went out and started killing people.
Yeah, not Afghanis. Afghanis is the currency, Afghans, but it's a common error. In fact, there was initially it was thought that he killed 17 Afghans.
Right.
And shortly after the massacre, what's very interesting is the Food and Drug Administration received an adverse event report of a soldier who had been taking Mefloquin, who was reported to have killed 17 Afghanis, which is close enough to the 16 Afghans that the news later reported for us to link that report to his case. Now, we don't know the provenance of this report. We don't know if it was submitted by someone with knowledge of events or whether it was someone misinterpreting what was being reported on the news as speculation as fact. We don't know. But it's suspicious enough that it, I think, should prompt further investigation. And it's certainly perfectly consistent. His case...
Has this been used as a mitigating factor? I mean, has it been brought up in court that this man was not responsible for his behavior because he was on a drug that can cause this very behavior?
Yeah, so I and a number of other observers had speculated that perhaps Bale's lawyer would try to raise the question of the Mefloquin intoxication at trial and use that as a defense or as a mitigating factor. But in fact, there would be good reasons for a competent defense attorney, I think, to forego that particular strategy. And in this case, the reason is that he would be tried by members of the military. And the military is still very, I think, reluctant to to acknowledge these effects. For many decades, the military had claimed that this was not possible, and mefloquine is perfectly safe. It doesn't cause these effects.
Right.
And I had thought that attempting to blame this on mefloquine would be seen by many as a Twinkie defense, if you're familiar with that terminology. There was a criminal case where I believe a man claimed that the sugar in the Twinkies made him do it.
Okay. I'd forgotten about that case. That was like from the 60s or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was some decades ago. But there is a possibility that particularly the military jurists might view the mefloquine defense as a Twinkie defense. And since mefloquine is used so pervasively, could every soldier blame their misconduct?
For everything.
And then, you know, it's interesting that his defense attorney was somehow able to negotiate having the death penalty taken off the table.
Right.
So Bales did not face the death penalty. He faces life in prison. And I find that interesting because there was clearly sufficient evidence to argue for the death penalty in his case.
Right.
It was a geopolitical disaster. It threatened our relations with our ally, gave us a bad name around the world. And when you compare it to arguably a comparable case, the case of Nadal Hassan, killed a large number of soldiers at Fort Hood.
Right.
In his case, the death penalty was not off the table.
Right.
So is the military saying that American soldiers' lives are worth more than lives of Afghans? Well, they might be implying that through the different punishments meted out, but you know, I'm obviously no lawyer, but I would think that there would have been sufficient evidence in either case to get the death penalty in both cases.
Right.
So I've speculated. This is bold speculation. I have no evidence to support this. But if both parties knew that Bales had been taking mefloquine, and if both parties suspected to a degree that mefloquine may have played a role in the events of that night, it would have been embarrassing for the military to pursue that line of inquiry, and it would have not guaranteed the defense a successful acquittal, by no means.
Right.
So I think that calculus might have supported an agreement, and this is purely speculative, but one could imagine an agreement whereby both parties agree that, well, if we don't talk about mefloquine, we'll take the death penalty off the table.
Okay, I can sort of see that. It might not even have been spoken. They might have just both known, and when the prosecution offered to do it, the defense might have understood why.
It's reasonable speculation, but
there's
absolutely no evidence to support this, and that theory does attempt to explain the seemingly the very odd lack of any discussion of this possibility, which was pervasive in the press at the time. So you know, we may never know what happened. It's entirely possible he never took the drug. It's entirely possible as well. But what we do know is that when he left Joint Base Lewis-McChord in the wintertime, he was issued a big bottle of doxycycline, which was then the preferred antimalarial for troops going to Afghanistan. But he was then assigned to a Special Forces unit. And Special Forces, at that time, still preferred the use of mefloquine. Special Forces medics will often just dispense pills without any record-keeping, and it's a very informal sort of thing. We know that Robert Bales did receive a number of prescription drugs from a Special Forces member without any documentation, so it's entirely plausible he also could have received Larium or mefloquine. What we do know is that when he was arrested at the start of the malaria season, when you would have expected the troops to be taking an antimalarial, what we do know was that his bottle of doxycycline was found in his possession unopened.
Oh, okay.
That is a fact. So It raises the question, if he wasn't taking his doxycycline, then what was he taking?
Yes, that's very interesting. It sounds like somebody could write an entire book about that that case, maybe uncover some further information. You also talked about the use of mefloquine in Guantanamo with the prisoners, and there's been suspicion that the side effects of mefloquine were the desired outcome, like that the drug was being used to punish people. Is there any grounds for that concern?
Well, that's a very interesting episode in the military's use of mefloquine. So we have to distinguish facts from speculation.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do know is that the military claims, based on their public statements, the military claims to have used mefloquine among new detainees at Guantanamo for the purposes of preventing the spread of malaria on the island of Cuba.
Right.
Which is a very interesting explanation. And in a paper I wrote some time ago, I break down that reasoning. So it's true that a number of detainees were captured from malaria-endemic areas with low malaria endemicity. Undoubtedly, a handful of these detainees would have had a malaria infection in their blood at the time they were captured. And in theory, there are mosquitoes on the island of Cuba. And so theoretically, it's possible that a mosquito may have bitten a detainee, and then that mosquito may have flown around for a while and bitten someone else, and then in theory you could have reintroduced malaria to the island of Cuba. In reality, though, that's exceedingly unlikely. And we routinely have visitors to Guantanamo on the island of Cuba that could be carrying malaria that we don't subject to this practice.
Right.
Now, giving detainees that dose of mefloquine, in fact, would not have reduced the risk of onward spread, because mefloquine doesn't act as a transmission-blocking agent. It only acts to kill the parasite during its sexual phases and not kill the stage of the parasite that actually is responsible for onward transmission. There's another drug we use, Primaquine, that would have been suitable for that purpose.
Right.
But one could say, well, maybe they were just being cautious.
Right.
So I would contrast what we did at Guantanamo with what we did a decade earlier, when we housed many thousands of potentially malaria-infected Haitian immigrants in exactly the same location at Guantanamo.
Right.
And at that time, we had mefloquine available. It was licensed. We didn't use mass prescribing of anti-malarials to reduce that risk. And in fact, all we did was we did a little vector control, and we identified new cases and treated them when they presented, and there was no risk of malaria reestablishing itself on Cuba through those practices.
Right.
When you look at what the CDC recommends, what major travel bodies recommend, they all recommend against doing what the military did in this particular case, which was mass administer this drug. So there's no corollary to any recent practice giving this mass dose of treatment dose of mefloquine.
Right.
It deviates from what the military did itself a decade earlier in comparable conditions. And it doesn't follow the recommendations of any major government or travel medicine body. So is there another explanation? Well, in retrospect, with the benefit of everything that's been released about the in-processing of detainees to Guantanamo, what we know is that their early weeks there were not benign experience. They arrived in the blindfolds and earmuffs and handcuffs, and soon after medical processing, many of them were frankly tortured. And we know that the goal of the treatment they experienced was to disorient them, was to break them down, was to make them more amenable to interrogation.
Right.
So that was the primary motivation of our government treating them the way they were being treated at that time.
So mefloquine you can't say whether it was used for that, but it would certainly fit into that goal.
So what we can say is we can say, well, what are the likely effects of mefloquine? And when you give mefloquine 5 tablets at a time, or 3 tablets at a time, and then 8 hours later, 2 tablets, what you note in study after study is that the vast majority of individuals given that very high dose will experience one or more potentially very disabling and frightful symptoms, to include disorientation, vertigo, dizziness, a sense of fear or panic, in some cases mild psychotic symptoms, a sense of dissociation, and some degree of amnesia. So it's reasonable to ask, among the group of individuals behind this dosing, did they have general knowledge of these symptoms? Was there knowledge in the literature that these symptoms would occur?
Yes. Right.
And could these symptoms plausibly assist in the overarching goals of that treatment?
Right.
What was taking place? Could the disorientation and nausea and dizziness and panic and amnesia assist the government and doing whatever they were doing to the detainees. And I think reasonably, I think we can all agree the answer is yes, that if the goal was to make the detainees uncomfortable and to make them more amenable to interrogation, that the effects of this drug would have plausibly assisted in that effort. And by giving mefloquine, the government can plausibly deny the intent. The government can say, "Well, we did this for a benign purpose,
public health purpose." Help. Yes.
Yeah, we were only trying to help. This was a kind, beneficent gesture on our part. We were only trying to protect the health of the detainees and protect the health
of
other residents in Guantanamo. And so it provides the government with plausible deniability. And of course, intelligence agencies, that's their currency.
Right. And of course, something like that would probably not really help get the truth out of somebody, but then it's been discovered that torturing people doesn't help get the truth out of them either, so the actual efficacy would be questionable.
No, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that. So so I'm not entirely convinced that the psychiatric or psychological effects of the quinolines are as poorly studied or this is as random and haphazard a process as you might guess. So I mentioned the World War II era drug development program, and the U.S. military spent significant money and time and effort during World War II to develop alternative synthetic anti-malarial drugs.
Right.
This was among our highest priority. It was sort of akin to the Manhattan Project. If we didn't have effective anti-malarials, we almost certainly would have lost the South Pacific campaign.
Right.
So this was a matter of some national urgency that had the support of the highest levels of the government, and with military involvement overseeing the entire thing. And what we know from transcripts of the Church Committee hearings in the 70s is that some of the drug testing done during the World War II era attracted the interest of what was then the OSA and would become the CIA.
Right.
That the psychiatric effects of this quinoline class of anti-malarials attracted the interest of the intelligence community. Way back then, and for obvious reasons, because you know, quite reasonably, we would be interested in drugs that made people lose touch with reality. The fact that we had this drug that could be used as an anti-malarial, that had this ostensible reason for use, that could have these other uses, obviously very useful, very intriguing property, worthy of further study. And it appears that in the aftermath of World War II, as the Cold War ramped up, you may be familiar with the project called MK Ultra.
Yes.
Which we know exists, which is widely publicized. We associate MK Ultra mostly with LSD.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we assume MK Ultra equals LSD, and there wasn't really much else under consideration. But in fact, there were just as many projects, if not more, that investigated in other classes of drug. And one of the classes of drug that was funded by MKUltra, and there's documentation of this, are the quinolines. And there was at least one physician in the D.C. area, and possibly others, that received funding to study the effects of the quinolines. And undoubtedly, they were investigating their psychological effects.
Right.
So for over a decade, MKUltra projects were investigating the mental health effects of quinoline. And when MKUltra was shut down, soon after that, the Vietnam-era anti-malarial drug development project started up again.
Right.
And we don't know if the people working on the World War II project then worked for MKUltra and then went back to work for the anti-malarial project. There's some evidence that is true. But there seems to have been an unbroken line of research into this class of drug, and undoubtedly somewhere within government there existed more detailed knowledge of the psychiatric effects of this class of drug, presumably to include mefloquine.
Which actually raises questions about, you know, how could they be researching the psychological side effects of a drug and then be denying that the drug has psychological side effects when it's given on a normal basis, maybe at a lower dose, but
yeah.
Still...
Well, I think you know the answer to that as
yes.
Well as everyone else does, for obvious reasons. You have to deny knowledge of that. There's an intriguing hypothesis, which is, again, bold speculation. But many people in the military know from personal experience that when they're on mefloquine, their personality changes just a little bit. They're a little more anxious. They're a little more aggressive. Many people will say, I'm just a little more trigger happy on this drug. And I think many folks in the military will attest to this, that were there to have been a crazed killing that takes place in a military unit, it most likely took place the day or two after taking Mefloquine.
People
call it Psycho Mondays or Psycho Tuesdays, Psycho Sundays.
Right.
Crazy pills, all sorts of names in the military for the effect of this drug. So we've often assumed that this effect is incidental.
Right.
That, this is, the reason we give this drug is because it's an effective antimalarial, and these effects are incidental.
Right.
But with knowledge that we've used this drug, most likely at Guantanamo, for its adverse psychological effects, and with documentation dating back to World War II, that this class of drugs was investigated by the intelligence community for its psychological effects, is it possible, and this is a terribly disturbing thing to consider, but is it possible that this drug, the development of this class of drugs, may have been motivated in part by a desire to have wide-ranging, mild psychological effects on troops, to aid in the war effort.
That is a disturbing possibility, but I can certainly see somebody saying
it's the Jacob's ladder conceit, isn't it? It's an idea that's been explored in fiction, quite a bit, with benefit of recent knowledge, it's not as outlandish as it sounds. Now, again, it's highly speculative. There's no proof of this, but I think it's reasonable to ask why, for so many years, we continued to use and rely on a class of drug that's just so inherently toxic and that has these effects, when safer and better tolerated classes of drugs became available. And why the military continued to insist on using this drug in place of these safer alternatives, could one explanation possibly be that this was viewed as some sort of performance-enhancing?
We've come to the end of the show, and this has been a really fascinating discussion. Can you update the status of mefloquine in the military now? Has it stopped being used, or its use reduced? And are the replacement drugs in a different class, or believed to be less toxic?
Yeah, great question. So the good news is, at least in the U.S. Military, for whatever reason, the military has decided that the risks are simply not worth the benefits. And so mefloquine has been demoted to a drug of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
Most people going overseas now will receive either the daily antibiotic, doxycycline, which is fairly safe and well-tolerated and very effective as an antimalarial. We were, in fact, using it before mefloquine became available, so we're going back to this drug.
Right.
That we had all along. And then even better is a drug called Malarone, Tovaquone Proguanil, combination drug. And we used that in our recent deployment to Liberia. We deployed 3,000 troops to Liberia for a few months. Only 5 cases of malaria, and 4 of those were in one unit we think probably wasn't all that compliant with their drug. So great success in reducing malaria. The troops were healthy. They didn't suffer the psychological problems that we saw on other deployments. And you contrast that with what happened 10 years ago when we sent just a few hundred Marines to the same spot in Liberia, and they were all notionally taking mefloquine, but many dozens became ill with malaria, and the mission had to be aborted. So I think the military's learned that mefloquine just doesn't work in real life very well, and that it's worth the expense to use the safer daily drugs to prevent malaria. So I think the military's moved away from this drug, but other countries still use it, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, that is good news, I guess. And I'd lastly like to thank the Canadian soldier who made me aware of this controversy and got me to give you a call. So thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been great talking to you.
Okay, goodbye.
Take care.